more examples do we need before Americans realize that government is the only entity with enough power to tell these companies that they must do things? That government is the only entity that can force companies to prioritize public safety, even if it reduces their profits, and that that is a good thing. This is why those that serve big business constantly want to reduce the size of government, why they constantly want to deregulate.
I am so damn tired of being lied to. I don't think I can deny it anymore.
Hello, my friend, and thank you for listening to the 293rd episode of the listener-supported Congressional Dish. I'm your host, Jennifer Briney. And I've been working on an episode about Boeing, because, as most of us know, I think, Boeing airplanes have recently had doors fly off mid-flight, and a few years ago, two brand new Boeing airplanes fell out of the sky. So clearly, there are big problems at Boeing, and Congress is investigating. And we do need to know about this because it's hard to fly anywhere in the United States and find a plane that isn't manufactured by Boeing. But while researching that episode, I was listening to three hearings, and one of them was from March 6th in the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation, where the chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, Jennifer Homendy, testified. The National Transportation Safety Board, since it was created in 1967, has investigated transportation accidents and crashes to determine their probable causes, examine safety issues, and create recommendations to prevent similar accidents and crashes in the future. The NTSB is one of my favorite parts of the United States government. The work of its approximately 400 or so employees have saved countless lives. And so I watched the NTSB chair's testimony about the January 5th Alaska Airlines flight, during which the door blew off in midair, to find out how in the hell that happened. And the details are not comforting, but that's a story for the next episode. But while Jennifer Homendy was answering questions about the Boeing situations, plural, because there are many, but during that hearing, there were a few other topics that were asked about by the senators, and there was information that I learned that kind of blew my mind. And I didn't want to wait for some applicable future deep dive episode to share this information with you. Because there's information I learned that's going to influence my decisions going forward, starting immediately. Specifically, decisions about whether or not I go on another helicopter tour in the United States. There's also information I learned that I think all first responders and tow truck drivers need to know right now. And there's information that I learned that you probably don't need to know right now, because what's done is done. But, you know, Norfolk Southern. That is a railroad company that poisoned Americans for no reason. And so I'm going to tell you what I mean by that, and I want to tell as many people as I can right now. Although the truth is that I'm not going to be doing the telling, because I don't really know anything. But Jennifer Homendy, as the chair of the NTSB, she does. And so she and members of Congress who are passionate about these topics, they are going to tell you, in snippets of unedited Senate testimony, what I wish were being played for us on mainstream corporate news. But none of this information makes corporate sponsors look good. Tourism companies, electric vehicle manufacturers, Tesla specifically, Norfolk Southern, an extremely powerful railroad corporation, all of them would lose business if this information were shared as widely as it should be, if the public were the corporate media's true customer. But as we know, the public is not. Companies are the customers of corporate media. They pay for the ads. But I don't get paid by them. I get paid by you. And so thank you for producing Congressional Dish at whatever amount you consider fair and feasible for your budget, and providing me with the incentive to stop what I'm doing and produce this quick episode for you so that you, at least, can have this information right away before you make decisions that could unwittingly put your family in danger. And maybe part of this desire of mine to get this information out as quickly as possible has to do with some of my own guilt. Now, I know you don't need to send me messages about this. I know I didn't do anything wrong because I had no way to know at the time. But I did put myself and others in danger when I worked for an activity booking company in Hawaii. I worked there for years. My job was to help tourists pick which activities they wanted to do while visiting the islands. And then I would hook them up with discounts if they went to a, it wasn't a timeshare presentation, but it was very similar. So basically a timeshare presentation. But a lot of people wanted discounts on helicopter and other airborne tours. You know, tourists wanted to see the Jurassic Park mountains and all of the coastlines that you can't access with a car. Who could blame them? It's amazing. And some psychos even wanted to throw themselves out of planes. And it was my job to make that affordable for them to do so. And I did. And I myself went on more than one of the helicopter tours, because why wouldn't I? I got to go for free. But every time I went on one of those tours, I was nervous. But to get myself into the helicopter, I told myself, you know, if this thing weren't safe to fly without doors, they wouldn't be allowed to, right? If it weren't safe for this stoner brudda, who seemed as a bit half-baked, to fly this thing, he couldn't, right? The government is making sure these things are safe, right? Like, I just figured that we have a functional government in the United States that would ensure those things. Well, here's Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin speaking to the chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, Jennifer Homendy.
I'm wondering if you could provide a status update on how you view the current safety standards for helicopter air tours, and do you believe that the safety provisions included in the Senate version of the FAA bill would improve the safety of these tours?
Thank you very much for your work on this issue and for Senator Schatz's work on this issue. I think it's critical. The NTSB believes in one level of safety. As before I became NTSB chair or before I worked on the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure, if I showed up with my family to take an air tour, I would not know to ask, what are the qualifications of the crew? What are your operating standards? What are your operating rules? What are your maintenance procedures? You wouldn't normally ask those questions. If you are somebody who shows up for a parachute jump flight, you think my biggest risk is jumping out of the plane, not getting on the plane, which also crashed in Hawaii. So we believe you're a paying passenger, whether you're on Part 121, Part 135, Part 91, you deserve the same level of safety. And we have advocated strongly for a set of regulatory standards that address just that. We've seen no action on that. This is something I have been extremely passionate about since I came to the board, whether it was Fly Nyon in New York, where we literally listened to people's last moments that were strapped into a helicopter on an air tour with a Home Depot harness that was supposed to hold them in, and they couldn't unhook it. They drowned. That is horrific. So still, we don't have the standards we've recommended. We did an entire report on ensuring safety in revenue passenger operations under Part 91. We looked at accidents, terrible tragedies in Hawaii, Arizona, I mentioned New York, Connecticut with a B-17 historic adventure flight that crashed. And each time we continue to say safety needs to improve, and each time we've been ignored. People, the public deserves better. FAA should issue standards to ensure their safety.
Now, I don't know what all of those parts of the law mean, but what I do understand fully from that testimony is that not all parts of aviation are governed the same. And the lady who knows things about transportation safety is, quote, extremely passionate, unquote, about helicopters and other tourism aircraft and the lack of safety regulations that currently exist to make sure that they are safely operated. And I can tell you this is going to change my behavior right now. Because this upcoming Thanksgiving, my family will be meeting up in Maui to celebrate my in-laws' 50-year wedding anniversary. And so all of us are going, my big, huge family, including my four nieces and nephews. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if my dear little daredevils would like to see Hawaii from a helicopter. And ordinarily, I would be the first to volunteer to take them, as I'm one of the few Brianies who's not afraid of heights. But now that I know this, there's no way. Not only will I not be taking the kids, but I will also use every bit of clout that I have in the family to try to convince them that none of us should go up in the sky while this remains the situation. Because the NTSB has made recommendations which the Federal Aviation Administration has not required the tour companies to implement. And therefore, these companies haven't been forced to install safety management systems that would give pilots real-time weather information, which the NTSB has recommended at least 6 times. The FAA has also failed to require training for pilots that would teach them how to spot and respond to hazardous weather conditions. As a longtime Kobe Bryant fan, this one hits hard. And after these accidents happen, there's no required flight tracking technology to help rescue crews find the accident sites. And on top of that, it's tough for the NTSB to learn what was happening on board because tourism aircraft and helicopters aren't required to have flight data recorders. All of that seems like basic stuff, but God forbid the free market be told what to do. And so I'm not going to be going up in the air anymore until I know that these basics, you know, real-time weather info, pilot training, flight tracking, and traffic alerts, until stuff like that is required, I'm staying out of that market. And now you have the information you need to decide whether or not you want to stay out of it too. Now, the next clip from that hearing that I want to play for you has to do with electric vehicles. It's no secret that I am yearning to live somewhere that doesn't require me to ever set foot inside of any vehicle because I hate them. Mainly, I hate cars because they are by far the most dangerous mode of transportation. You know, back when I started this show about a decade ago, when I looked up the number of Americans killed every year by cars, I was blown away to learn that we were losing about 33,000 Americans every year. And I used to put that into context by saying that we were having 11 9/11s every year on our roadways. And I was baffled by how we would declare and fight a global war over one 9/11, but that we just accept 11 of them on our roads every year as if that's just the natural order of things. But I can't say that anymore because things have changed. Instead of having 11 9/11s every year, we are now closer to having 14 9/11s on our roads every year, more than one every month. That's about 42,000 humans killed on American roads every year. And on top of that, there are over 2 million Americans who are injured in car accidents every year. Traveling by car is so dangerous, but United States infrastructure has been built for them. Drivers get their infrastructure mostly provided for them with tax money, while other forms of transportation, which are far safer, must be paid for out of pocket by users. It's one of the things I hate most about living in the United States. But I am living here right now, and I need a car in this unnecessarily dangerous car culture that we have. And so I choose to drive a partially electric vehicle. Because I would like to drive a fully electric vehicle, but we don't have enough charging infrastructure installed in the United States to allow me to drive a fully electric, just because I'm someone who occasionally has to drive across the country. So even having them in my local area, it's just not enough. But as capable as loving a car as I can possibly be, I do love my EV hybrid. And I love my dad's fully electric Chevy Bolt. I love almost never having to go to a gas station. And I love that when I'm driving past people on the sidewalks, I love knowing that I am not harming them in any way. Unlike people who are driving fossil fuel guzzlers who are constantly spewing poisons out of their tailpipes. But recently I've noticed a trend that I don't love in electric vehicles, which is the trend of massive, terrifying to all pedestrians monster trucks on our roads, which used to be the exclusive domain of fossil fuel guzzlers. But now those monster trucks are going electric. We have one that I hate that has just moved into my building, as some new resident has an electric Hummer. This thing is the bane of my charging existence. Because in this building that I live in, we have 4 parking spaces with EV chargers that we all have to share out of 5 stories of parking spots in our garage. And I hate the electric Hummer not only because it takes pretty much an entire day to charge, making the rest of us have to share the remaining 3 spots, and not only because it's wider than our parking spots, making for a tough fit for everyone else, and not only because it has obnoxious blue lights along the entire front grill while it's charging, just screaming, "Look at me!" even when it's supposed to be just minding its own business. It is the ultimate attention whore vehicle. But mostly I hate it because I feel unsafe around it. I'm almost 6 feet tall, and the grill comes up to my chin. My volleyball coach, who is a full-grown badass of an adult, is 5 feet 4 inches tall, and the driver wouldn't be able to see her in front of this thing. And a small child? Please, roadkill. The size of these giant cars feels unsafe because they are, and I don't love seeing the trend go electric. But it turns out that I'm not worried enough about this. Because there are some unique characteristics of electric vehicles specifically that make giant electrics even more deadly than their fossil fuel guzzling, poison spewing twins on our roads. Here's Senator Eric Schmidt of Missouri speaking to the chair of the NTSB, Jennifer Homendy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
I did have some questions. I know that Senator Fisher mentioned some of this earlier as relates to electric vehicles. The weight of some of these vehicles, including, I know you mentioned, the battery alone can be the weight of a Honda Civic or a Toyota Corolla. Mm-hmm. And so there's certainly safety issues there that relates to guardrails and other vehicles on the road. You would agree with that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's also issues that I want to talk about our infrastructure, too. The weight of these vehicles, the strain that it can have on parking garages, roads, and bridges, the amount of money that will be expended to either reinforce or repair. Who is looking at this? Because we have a mandate for auto manufacturers to produce 50% of their fleet to be electric vehicles by 2030. I know there's a new rule in the works to have that number increased. I don't know if it's 65% or 75% by 2032. That's being considered. So it seems to me we're entering this phase as it relates to these mandates for electric vehicles, and all of these repercussions, all of these ancillary concern, I don't know who's addressing it. So I'm asking you, are you guys looking at this? Who is looking at this? Because this seems to be a disaster on the horizon for the American people and our infrastructure, but I don't hear a lot of talk about it.
Thank you, Senator. I have raised this consistently over the past year and a half, starting with the Transportation Research Board, where I raised concerns with respect to increasing size and weight of all vehicles, but particularly the weight of electric vehicles, that we really needed to look at the safety impact, not just on crashes, but to our infrastructure as well, and protecting people. The whole reason why we have a guardrail is to protect people when there is a crash, yet it wouldn't withstand some of the crashes with some of these high weights of heavy vehicles, including heavy electric vehicles, as was demonstrated by the University of Nebraska. Somebody needs to take action here. We have repeatedly flagged it. It is within the Department of Transportation's purview to do that, and I encourage them strongly to get ahead of it. We're behind right now.
If we are going to continue fully subsidizing driving in the United States the way that we have for my entire lifetime, which the bipartisan infrastructure law that I read for you back in 2021 makes crystal clear that we are, well, electric cars are a good idea for climate and mass poisoning reasons. But we can't blind ourselves to the downsides. And perhaps allowing electric monster trucks, or monster trucks in general, on our roads is not a wise move for society. Especially if we don't want to subsidize driving infrastructure all over again to retrofit everything to accommodate these ridiculous displays of male insecurity, which would be a massive taxpayer expense. Because God forbid, politically, drivers have to pay one penny out of pocket for their infrastructure. But if we don't want to pay for these retrofits, which I don't, And if we don't want to sacrifice safety in an already unsafe vehicle transportation environment, which I don't, we need to seriously consider regulating monster EVs out of existence, because they are dangerous in too many ways. And on top of the concerns about the weight of electric vehicles, which make monster EVs even more dangerous to people and infrastructure in a crash than monster fossil fuelies, well, the batteries are also causing new hazards for first and secondary responders. Once again, here's Senator Eric Schmidt of Missouri speaking to the NTSB chair, Jennifer Homendy.
As it relates to first responders who are responding to, you know, crashes or other, you know, that are involved, that lithium batteries are involved with, what is your take on the safety for our first responders as they're responding to these EV crashes?
It's a significant danger. We issued a report just a few years ago raising concerns regarding a number of crashes that we investigated involving electric vehicles and the risk to emergency responders from stranded energy inside the battery and components, and the significant potential for shock. We also raise concerns with respect to secondary responders, which are the tow truck operators, because we saw many of these vehicles reigniting on the tow truck and up to 5 days later in the tow yard.
One of my oldest friends, I'm very proud to say, is a firefighter. In fact, he's probably going to be a captain pretty soon, and I'm very, very proud of him. But when I saw this clip, I decided to shoot him a text. And so right now I'm going to read you our exchange. So I texted him, "Hey, I'm researching an episode. Have you given or taken any training on fighting electric vehicle fires specifically? The NTSB says that they are seeing EV fires being harder to fight and the cars are reigniting on tow trucks and in storage yards up to 5 days later." And he responded, 100%. It's a major problem in firefighting right now. Additionally, the health hazard is extremely high. We have one guy who went into kidney failure post-exposure and will never be a firefighter again. Not to mention the cancer increase potential of these exposures. There are a few different techniques that are being developed in order to combat these fires, and I've done some research and training, but also have a lot of other people and contacts that have done more. And so I asked him, does training for this already exist, or are you guys kind of having to wing it? And he said, we're slightly past the wing it phase, but only slightly. And so if firefighters are only at the slightly better than winging it stage, where do we think our tow truck drivers are? Or how about the people who work in the yards where the crash wreckage is stored? You know, I drive one of these vehicles and I wasn't aware that the batteries were able to reignite 5 days after a crash. Like, what if someone gets their wrecked car towed home and stores it in their garage? Could it reignite there? Is it a problem if we're not aware that that's a possibility? Like I said, we can't be blind to the risks, even if we support a transition to electric cars. And speaking of electric cars, we need to talk about Tesla, but not about their batteries, but about their self-driving technology. Now, I've had a controversial opinion for a long time, and I've held it since long before it became cool, which is that I think that Elon Musk, the owner of Tesla, is a menace to society. Now, this is nothing personal, because I really don't think it's his fault. And if I met him, I'm sure I'd like the dude. But his wealth allows him to play global decision maker. Because when a single man has more wealth than most countries, when one man's wealth would make him the 50th richest country if he were his own government, then the world really is his playground. And he's chosen to use that wealth to play the role of global decision maker. Elon Musk is making decisions about the creation and therefore existence of robot technologies that are more intelligent than humans. Elon Musk is a significant decision maker in our space program. He alone decides if entire countries get internet access via satellites during a war. Elon Musk owns and makes all the rules for one of the world's largest digital communication networks. And Elon Musk is deciding to test experimental car technologies on our public roads. He shouldn't have the ability to play so many important decision-making roles in the world without having been elected by anyone, but our tolerance for extreme wealth allows it. And he's been reckless with his power, which is not being held in check by our gutted government. Here's some testimony to Congress about the technology he's being allowed to test in Teslas on our roads. Here's Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts speaking to the chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, Jennifer Homendy.
Now I'd like to turn to the significant risk posed by autonomous vehicles. In the past 8 years, the NTSB has investigated multiple incidents involving autonomous driving technologies like Tesla's autopilot system that are designed to operate in specific road conditions, particularly on highways. In fact, in 2016, NTSB recommended that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and auto manufacturers restrict drivers from activating these systems outside those road conditions. It's long past time that we take firm control of the wheel and steer towards safety and implement this recommendation. So, Madam Chair, can you briefly explain the reasoning for this recommendation?
Yes, and in fact, I thought this may come up because this is you're a champion on this issue, and I just pulled Tesla's statement on, which is really their limitations on operational design domain. They warn on their website for those who have vehicles that some of their automation will not work in some areas, including areas of poor visibility, heavy rain, snow, fog, bright light, oncoming headlights, direct sunlight, mud, ice, snow, interference or obstruction by objects mounted onto the vehicle, narrow, high curvature or winding roads, a damaged or misaligned bumper, an extremely hot or cold temperature, an area where the vehicle is not designed to operate using that technology. Who reads that? We have to make...
Well, that just leaves you backing out of the driveway and then going back into your car again, because other than that, you're back out, you're out on the road. This isn't like the Postal Service who rain, sleet, snow, gloom of night. They're saying, well, the sunlight might affect it, or the snow might affect it, or rainy conditions might affect it, winding roads might affect it. So as I'm listening to that description, it sounds like, to me, it's not ready for prime time. It's not ready to be handed over to people who have grown up with a car that they drive where they expect the brakes or the steering wheel to all work, no matter where they're going. Oh, by the way, this thing that you just turned on could be extremely dangerous for your two kids in the back seat.
Well, and if it's only designed to be operated in a certain type of environment, it should be limited to those environments. We issued that recommendation to Tesla following the 2016 tragedy in Williston, Florida. We issued the same recommendation to NHTSA. We issued it again. Both have failed to act on those recommendations.
And so how do I intend to use this information to stay alive? Well, first of all, I will not buy a Tesla. And I will not be a passenger in a Tesla where the driver is using the self-driving capabilities. And I will report any Uber or Lyft drivers who do. Also, as a pedestrian, if I see a Tesla or self-driving car acting strangely, I will assume that it's going to behave in an unpredictable way and will do whatever I can to protect myself from it. You know, get behind a tree or duck into a building. I will be hyper-vigilant when I'm around these cars, perhaps to the point of looking paranoid to others, because I know, confirmed by the NTSB chair, that the technology is not ready to be driving on our roads. Like I said, Elon Musk is a menace. It's not really his fault. It's our fault that we are allowing him, collectively, as a self-governing populace. And it's not just him, we are allowing Elon Musk and all of the self-driving vehicle companies to release new technology onto our already unsafe roads without going through any kind of approval process. The vehicle market should not be free to do what it wants on our public roads. And yet, because we have regulation fear, that's precisely what is happening. Well, I, for one, do not have regulation fear. I have a fear of being hit and killed by a car. And I just wish more priority were placed on my freedom to be alive than the freedom of companies from regulation. And speaking of companies that are free from regulation, here's some information about the reckless railroad tycoons of our time, specifically Norfolk Southern, which is one of the big four. Because cross-country railroad infrastructure in the United States was constructed mostly with government money in the 1800s, But private companies owned by the richest of American families got that government money to do the actual work. And in that construction process, somehow, those oligarchs got themselves ownership of the infrastructure, of the actual tracks themselves. And today, private companies own the railroad tracks in the vast majority of our country, everywhere outside of the Northeast. As owners, private companies are the decision makers about what happens on most of our railways, on our critical infrastructure. And because their tracks run through our communities, we kind of just have to trust that they're operating safely and that the safety of our communities through which they have the right of way, we have to trust that that safety always comes first. But there are serious questions about what was prioritized, safety or company profits, in the response to Norfolk Southern's train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, on the night of February 3, 2023, during which 38 train cars flew off the tracks, 11 of them carrying hazardous chemicals. Local officials were told that five of those tank cars, which were full of chemicals and lying sideways on the tracks, could possibly explode and possibly kill everyone within a one-mile radius. To prevent that explosion, the decision was made to burn five of those cars containing vinyl chloride, which is a chemical that's used to create plastic PVC pipes, and exposure to its gas form is known to increase your risk of liver and other kinds of cancer. When burned, though, vinyl chloride releases poisonous chemicals such as hydrogen chloride and phosgene, the latter of which was used as a weapon in World War I because it's so poisonous to humans. Symptoms of exposure include trouble breathing and vomiting, and then hydrogen chloride is known to cause irritation to your skin, eyes, nose, and throat. And all of those symptoms have been reported by residents of East Palestine, Ohio. As gases, these chemicals dissipate quickly, but burning vinyl chloride also produces dioxins, which can remain in the ground and stored in our body's fat tissue for years. And so basically, it's not cool for these chemicals to get into our food chain. And what burns up must fall down. And there are many farms and humans to the east of East Palestine. And there are a lot of people, myself definitely included, who are concerned about the long-term effects that burning five rail cars full of vinyl chloride could be having on Americans and our food supply in Ohio and locations to its east. And in this Senate hearing in March, Congress was told more about how that decision to burn the five cars full of chemicals and create that toxic cloud which horrified everyone who saw it in person or in pictures was made. And so, here's Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio talking to the chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, Jennifer Homendy.
February 3rd, 2023 derailment of the train. Is it true that Norfolk Southern's contractors monitored temperatures on one of the chemical tank cars from the afternoon of February 5th into the afternoon of February 6th, which is when the controlled burn happened, and communicated their initial readings to OxyVinyls, the shippers in charge of the vinyl chloride cars?
That's accurate, Senator.
Is it true that these readings indicated an initial temperature of 135 degrees Fahrenheit at 4 p.m. on February 5th, which eventually declined to 126 degrees Fahrenheit at 9:30 a.m. on February 6th, at which point it stabilized?
That's correct, Senator. It was stabilized well before the vent and burn, many hours before.
So declining temperatures, you would think, and stabilized temperatures are consistent not with something that needs to be exploded, but with something that can be dealt with in a slightly less catastrophic way. At least that's my read on it. But is it true that the chemical shipper OxyVinyls concluded that the reported and stabilized tank car temperatures were too low for a runaway chemical reaction, meaning the sort of thing that would lead to an uncontrolled explosion?
That's correct. They had testified that polymerization was not occurring. In order for polymerization to occur, which was the Norfolk Southern and their contractors' justification for the vent and burn, you would have to have rapidly increasing temperatures and some sort of infusion of oxygen, neither of which occurred.
Right. And just to be clear, you would need both of those things. It's not an either or. You need both of them to precipitate polymerization, which would lead to an uncontrolled situation. So is it true that Norfolk Southern's contractors testified to the NTSB that they were not certain a chemical reaction was occurring in the derailed vinyl chloride tank car?
They testified to that, yes, sir.
Is it correct that the chemical shippers testified that there was no free radical agent or sufficient heat trajectory to justify Norfolk Southern contractors' assessment that a chemical reaction was occurring?
That's correct.
So from this assessment, Is it your understanding that Norfolk Southern's contractors lack scientific basis to support their conclusion that polymerization was occurring in the derailed VCM tank cars?
Yes. In fact, they were informed by OxyVinyls of the information that should have been taken by the contractors in their decision making. But yes, they did not have that. They lacked the scientific background to address that.
So let me just go to sort of one final question here. We combine all these facts together. Your reporting thus far concludes that Norfolk Southern's contractor's recommendation to conduct a controlled burn lacked sufficient scientific basis, disregarded available temperature data, and contradicted expert feedback from the shipping firm on site. Now, this was all told to the decision makers on the ground that they had to make a decision in less than 13 minutes to blow up all five of these toxic chemical cars without any other voices being included to offer a contrary opinion. Is that right?
That's correct.
So, again, I appreciate your work on this, but just to sort of summarize, this is an extraordinary finding. We were told effectively that there were two bad options, the controlled burn or the uncontrolled explosion. And it seems, based on the data that we have, that there was not a ton of reason to do the uncontrolled burn. And that, of course, is what spread toxic chemicals all over this community and the surrounding region. It's really an extraordinary finding. It goes to highlight the importance of your work. But I also have to note that residents on the ground talk about the fact that immediately after the uncontrolled burn, they moved the tank cars and train traffic was moving through their town and through their community. I won't ask you to speak to motivations here, but when you have an unnecessary uncontrolled burn that poisoned a lot of people that then led to rapid transit of train traffic, a lot of people, including me, are wondering, did they do this not because it was necessary, but because it allowed them to move traffic and freight more quickly? And if so, that is an extraordinary thing that I think requires a lot of further work from this committee and from others. But we will stop there because I see my time is up. Thank you, Chair Halmody.
May I add something to that?
Please.
Senator, it's even, I would say the factual information in our docket shows that OxyVinyls was on scene and providing information to Norfolk Southern and their contractors on the 4th, 5th, and 6th. They informed them that polymerization was not occurring and there was no justification to do a vent and burn. Rightfully, Norfolk Southern's contractors said ruled out hot tapping and transloading because it would have been a potential safety issue for their employees. But there was another option. Let it cool down. It was cooling down. We know for a fact that when that pressure relief device went off, that it had to have been above 185 degrees. Later, over the course of 22 hours, that tank car was cooling, not to mention the other four tank cars that were only between 64 and 69 degrees. So OxyVinyls was on scene providing information to Norfolk Southern's contractor who was in the room when the decision was made and when advice was given to the governor of Ohio, to the incident commander. They were not given full information because no one was told OxyVinyl was on scene. They were left out of the room. The incident commander didn't even know they existed. Neither did the governor. So they were provided incomplete information to make a decision.
There were scientists there who were telling them that setting those cars on fire was unnecessary. And there have already been settlements made, and I don't know if this was taken into account. There's already been a $310 million settlement that was done between Norfolk Southern and the Department of Justice and EPA. And there's already been a $600 million class action that's been settled with the East Palestine residents earlier this year. So did this factor into their lawsuits? I don't know. But one thing that I would like to know is who's going to prison? because someone belongs locked in a cage for a while for choosing to keep that information, that there was no danger that the five cars were going to explode, someone needs to be punished for keeping that information from the government decision makers. You know, because if higher ups were punished for profits over people decisions like that, there would probably be fewer examples of profits over people decisions being made. And so I want a higher up within Norfolk Southern or whoever decided to keep that information quiet. I want someone at the executive level to go broke or get locked up, because we go broke and get locked up for far less serious actions. And before we finish up with the railroads, here's a bit more information about the state of our rail network and its safety, especially for rail workers, under the control of the big four private corporations. Here's Chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, Jennifer Homendy.
So the derailment rate is sort of a combined rate from mainline track and for the yards. We are seeing a significant increase in derailments and tragedies in the yards. That is where we're very concerned about employee safety. We've seen that repeatedly. We've issued a number of recommendations. We have a lot of open investigations. For Norfolk Southern alone, we have 8 investigations that are currently open, and we're also doing a safety culture review separate from East Palestine. But in particular, we have 190 safety recommendations that we've issued that are currently open to improve rail safety, whether it's preventing fatigue or providing for increased inspection or new technologies to supplement, not supplant workers, supplement the work to ensure safety. Those 190 have not been acted upon. Happy to provide those for the hearing record, but they can be today, and I hope they will.
190 recommendations which are being ignored. And as I'm watching this, the question that keeps running through my mind is, why aren't there recommendations requirements? Why do we allow the companies who made the mistakes, the companies whose negligence cost lives and poisons entire communities, why do we give them choices when the NTSB determines that there are things they should be doing to operate safely? Like, I am so sick of market freedom, I could scream. Because businesses are not supposed to be free. They're supposed to be governed by government. When the market is free to govern itself, it has chosen, private companies have chosen, time and time again, to prioritize their own profit over safety. How many more examples do we need before Americans realize that government is the only entity with enough power to tell these companies that they must do things? That government is the only entity that can force companies to prioritize public safety, even if it reduces their profits, and that that is a good thing. This is why those that serve big business constantly want to reduce the size of government, why they constantly want to deregulate. Business titans and those who get paid in profit shares do not want businesses to be governed, because they want to prioritize profits and not be forced by anyone to pay to install basic technologies in their planes, to not be forced by anyone to limit the size of their profitable but dangerous trucks, to not be forced by anyone to shut down their tracks to responsibly clean up their messes. Self-governing is profitable for them because it's the public who always pays. And until we learn that lesson, there's going to be more testimony like this. Until American society learns enough lessons to start prioritizing effective government enforcement, we need to do the best we can to protect ourselves. It's a savage reality as a resident of the United States, but it is in fact our reality. And at least I hope that this episode today is going to help you protect yourself and your family and your kids on vacation and in your neighborhoods in some way. Okay, so executive producers are going to be announced on the Boeing episode because that's the episode that the Congressional Tish team has been working on. I just kind of did this one on my own. But I do want to know if you liked this episode, because for years, I've been listening to hearings and have heard interesting things that had nothing to do with the topic I was working on. And I've even listened to entire hours-long hearings and heard, you know, like one total interesting thing, but it was still interesting and important. I just didn't have anywhere to put it. And the information like that, which hasn't fit into my topics, has just kind of languished in my notes because I've never figured out a way to fit those clips in and to connect topics. But if you don't mind shorter mixed bag type episodes like this, highlighting random interesting stuff, well, this is a type of episode I could do for you more often. And so please let me know in the comments of this episode on Patreon. And if you're not supporting the show per episode on Patreon, I will also read and consider feedback that comes in along with your Venmos and PayPals and Zelles and Cash Apps and checks. Because quite frankly, it's the producer's opinions that are the only ones that matter to me with this value for value business model, where I provide you a valuable episode and you return that value in whatever financial form you like using and in an amount you consider fair. But the reality is that you have to be on the production team to have your production notes heard. Lucky for you, though, the price to be on the Congressional Dish team is cheap. Pay literally anything and you're in. And so, please, producers, let me know. If this episode does make me some money, I'll do more episodes like it. And if it doesn't, or if it results in my Patreon going down, that'll be my answer. We're about to witness the value for value market at work, baby. Also, please share this with your friends, especially those who would be likely to go on flying tourism adventures, and your first responder friends. And if you know anyone who drives a tow truck, they should probably know about this too. And as always, thank you for listening. Next up is the Boeing episode, and so I will talk to you as soon as that's done. Thanks. Bye.
We don't have a domestic spying program.
They're content to fight in black and white despite the many in-betweens. We got a president who plays with the facts.
With the facts.
And then he waves a flag to cover his tracks. As if a lie is all right, if the end will justify the means. Now we are so damn tired of being lied to.
The polar ice caps aren't going away.
We don't.
Government jobs consume the profits of the private sector.
We don't think we can deny it anymore. You can stick to your story if you think it flies. But we're not keeping quiet anymore.
These bills represent common sense, bipartisan solutions that actually solve problems.